All right, well, good morning, everybody. We're in 1 Corinthians, and we're going to continue pressing through. I last week didn't get as far as I wanted, but it's okay. It kind of breaks at a good place. Remember, this is the church of all kinds of problems. They really do. And they have divisions. And the real problem that we were dealing with last week and that we'll continue this week is this matter that they have someone in the church who's having an affair with his stepmother. Now, this is the first of several very specific issues he deals with. He dealt broadly with divisions, and when you get down to it, they're bubbling with pride. Pride causes people to knock heads together and get in quarrels, and they've got that. But they've got a number of specific issues, and he doesn't name this guy, but I suspect he could have. The fact that he doesn't name him tells you everybody knows. No one got this letter and said, I wonder who the guy is sleeping with his stepmother. Right? It didn't happen because they all knew. And the fact that they all knew and did nothing about it, that's the problem. They all knew. So he says, and I think we read this verse last time, but I wanted to go back to it because there's really a lot here. He says, your glorying is not good. See, rather than being ashamed of this guy and ashamed that they've sort of let the problem persist in the local church, they're boasting. That's what the word glory means, to boast. They're boasting about it. He says, that's not good. You know, don't you know that a little leaven leaveneth the whole lump? There are a number of places in Scripture where that concept, that picture of leaven gets used, and I had a note on this. Like, it's used, and I'm just reading this just by example, the leaven of the Pharisees and of Herod. That's in the Gospels, like in Matthew 22. The leaven of the Sadducees, Jesus will refer to in Matthew 16. The leaven of the Corinthian church, we see here. Paul refers to the leaven of legalism in Galatians. I mean, it's a common phrase. It doesn't always mean something negative, but it usually seems to. It becomes a metaphor for something negative. Now, in reality, the leaven is the yeast that you put in a lump. And there are, you know, stories that are told of, I think they're true, of people that, because I had read one that, you know, some lady immigrated over here, an older lady that brought a little bit of her dough for making bread from the old country. And every time you make bread, you keep a little of the dough behind to mix into the next batch of bread. And she'd been working with that same lump, in essence, for 50 years. And then she passed it on to her daughter and the granddaughter, you know, and because that's what it does, it propagates. And he says a little, you know, don't you know, this is a rhetorical question, of course they know, a little leaven does leaven the whole lump. Hey, good morning.
Good morning, guys. Just want to come and say hello. I'm sorry to interrupt, just had to come and say hi to you.
Yeah. Good morning.
Enjoy your time.
All right, thanks. He's going to use an illustration, though, from some Old Testament feasts, and that's why I didn't want to go over this too quickly. The New Testament makes reference to all these feasts. There are, do you know how many biblical feasts there are? Not Jewish feasts, but feasts that are Jewish feasts that are actually in the Bible. There's some that aren't.
Seven.
Yeah, seven. There's seven main feasts. There's, and by that, I should clarify about them being in the Bible. They're the ones that are mandated, right? There is a feast of Purim that seems to be, have a background in the book of Esther, for example. So there's some other feasts, and there's a number of things that, you know, the dedications. There were some fasting days that came up. They weren't prescribed back in the Torah, but like when they were in captivity in Babylon for 70 years, they began a number of fasts. And when you get to Zechariah chapter 7, you'll read about those fasts because the question's been raised of, well, now that we're not in captivity, do we still have to fast? So there's a number of these, but certainly the seven that the Bible required you to do, and the Old Testament required you to do, they're important, and they all get talked about in the New Testament. For one thing, Jesus attended the Passover, for example. Okay, the first recorded time that we have of him attending is in Luke when he was 12 years old. Remember what happened? He kind of stayed behind, and his parents brought him to the Passover. Jewish practice was that when you were 12, that was usually the first time you, as a young man, young boy, would go to, you know, you go to the Passover feast in Jerusalem. In any event, that's recorded, and Jesus stays behind. So you see that. Jesus, as a Jewish man, did not have the option of skipping Passover. We read in the Gospels of four different Passovers, the one when he was young, and then the three during his earthly ministry. Just understand, like, when you're reading that stuff, like, that's not optional. Like, he had to go. It would have been, I don't know that you could say he was sinless had he skipped them. I'm just saying. So, you know, as a Jewish, you know, man in that time, he had to go. So these are a big deal. Now, the Corinthians, they probably have some Jewish people or proselytes. They're mostly Gentile. But Paul uses this imagery. I need to get y'all's email addresses at some time, because I was going to print this thing out. And it's just some notes I had from a long time ago. But just to say, you know, you had Passover, unleavened bread, and the sheaf of first fruits. Those are three feasts that happen all on the same 8 days in sort of the first month of their calendar. Passover, what's that celebrate? Don't think New Testament, think Old Testament. What's Passover celebrating? What do they do? I mean, just big picture. When was it kept the first time? Yeah, when they left Egypt, right? And Moses, you know, he has to teach this to them, but they put lamb's blood on the doorpost. And what happened? If they're inside the house, lamb's blood on the doorpost, no death.
They ate the lamb.
Okay. Yeah, and of course, they would eat the lamb. It's like they're discarding the animal. There's a whole lot to the feast and a lot of details that developed by the first century when Jesus participates in the Last Supper, as we call it. He instigates or initiates the Lord's Supper, which is you know, talked about in 1 Corinthians, where he alters the Seder meal in some certain specific respects to become the Lord's Supper. But that's, we'll deal with that in chapter 11, because Paul will talk about that in chapter 11, and the Gospels talk about that. But just understand that the Passover was when they came out of Egypt. And they would keep it in the future because it would remind them that God freed them from bondage. I mean, that was the reminder. The Feast of Unleavened Bread starts immediately after that. Hey, come in. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, what's unleavened bread first? Good morning.
Bread without yeast.
Yeah, bread without yeast, right? We call them tortillas. Right, right, but there's different kinds of bread without yeast. But I mean, you know, that is, you can prepare it in different ways. But it's really not much to it. It's flour and oil.
It's quick.
It is quick. I mean, I had these notes, and this was November 2007 when I taught about unleavened bread that day, and we had a big room because it was a very large class. But some of the ladies made the unleavened bread for us, and we ate it. That morning, just so we would, you know, think about what they were doing. When they kept the Feast of Unleavened Bread, you essentially have Passover, and then immediately you're in the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And a lot of times you could even refer to the Passover, and you really mean that whole week period of time, not just the one day. And the bread was called the bread of affliction because, frankly, you don't normally want to eat unleavened bread. You want bread that's leavened because it fills your belly. And so you're remembering back when you were in toil and slavery. It's kind of pointing back. But during this feast, you were not allowed to have leaven in the country, okay, in the whole country. The idea was not to have leaven within the borders, which is interesting because they're even developed during time. You can read about it in history, a practice where men would get their leaven together they have in their house because you might need it, and they would sell it to a Gentile and then buy it back after the feast, that kind of thing, things like that. In a modern practice, a husband might go put some of this in a certain part of the house, like, you know, and mom knows where it is, and then ceremonially she goes and gets it and removes it from the house. Why are they removing leaven from the house?
One tradition would be throw it into the fire.
Oh yeah, throw it in the fire. It had to be discarded. You didn't want any leaven in the house. But what would the leaven represent?
Sin.
Sin, right? Because you're removing sin, lawlessness from your home and from the very borders of the country. So that was the picture of the feast, and there's a lot to it. I hadn't thought about it in great detail in a while, so I printed these old notes I had, but just that's the idea. Now, one thing would happen in the middle of every Feast of Unleavened Bread, because it ran 7 days, there has to be a Sunday in there. And that Sunday is always the Feast of the Sheva First Fruits. That's Resurrection Sunday. So there's a lot of symbolism there we won't get into today because it's not here in 1 Corinthians. But Jesus' resurrection on a Sunday wasn't just because God said, let's make it on a Sunday. No. God said, let's make it on the Sheva First Fruits. There was a very specific reason, because Jesus is the first fruits of a new humanity in Christ. And just to say, so there's lots of symbolism. The other feasts aren't mentioned here, but in 1 Corinthians 15, I'm pretty sure there's a reference to the feast we would call Feast of Trumpets, not the Jewish term for it, but the Gentile way of saying it. But the other feasts are talked about in the New Testament. You know, Feast of Tabernacles, or sometimes called Feast of Booths, that's in the Gospels. So these things matter, and it's all getting to this. Paul says, now he's talking to a local church that's just full of problems. Purge out the old leaven. The Jewish person knows the picture. The Gentile will have to think about it a little bit, but it's not that hard. You need to purge it out. Why? That you could be a new lump as you were unleavened, okay? Sinless. Now, he's not talking about people being perfect, but when we're aware of sin, we need to deal with it. And that's an individual thing, but also in this specific context, in a church. Remember, I called the lesson last week, publicly flaunted sin. There's always people in the church, and everyone in here is one of them, that has some sin issues going on. But there's a difference between the fact that we're not perfect yet, we haven't totally arrived and won't until we have resurrection bodies. And there's a difference between that and a publicly flaunted sin that's bringing reproach to the church. It's losing our testimony. That's what they were dealing with. And so he says you got to purge it out. And they understand it. Individually, I should be trying to purge out the sin of my life. Areas where I become aware that I'm not in line with God's standard of holiness. But as a church as well, he says, for even Christ, our Passover, right? The lamb in the first century would be slain at 3 p.m. in the afternoon. It would be slaughtered, cooked, so that before essentially sunset, you'd have that food ready. And then when you had the what we might now call a Seder meal, when you had that, you would eat the lamb. And there was some ritual involving real wine and the lamb, some bitter herbs, and just different things, some hand washing. There was a lot to it. He's saying Jesus was our Passover. He fulfilled it. Why would that be? Well, because his one sacrifice, one time in history, on Friday at 3 p.m. in the afternoon, on April the 3rd, 33 A.D., likely, could have been in 30 A.D., probably 33, but at that specific time, and John's very specific in his gospel about this 3 p.m. thing, couldn't be 2 and it couldn't be 4. It had to be that he had to die at the moment when people were out slaughtering their lambs for their Passover, and he dies, and he becomes the one Passover, and we don't ever need another. See, we don't ever need another, right? Because Christ doesn't need to be crucified again. And so he's our Passover. He's sacrificed for us. Therefore, see, this ought to be a motivator. If Christ died for you, and that's provided for our sins, we ought now, in light of his Passover, not the Passover using a lamb, the Passover with the Lamb of God that takes away the sins of the world, for that reason, we should keep the feast. Which feast? The Feast of Unleavened Bread, because that's what comes immediately after the Passover. But how do we keep it? We don't need to go around the house doing what was symbolic, and that is removing the yeast, although you have liberty to do that. And I know Christians who will keep some of the Jewish feast in that way. That's not a problem. But what Paul has in mind is keeping the feast not with the old leaven, in other words, not dealing with the physical that all that represented, not with the leaven of malice and wickedness either, which is what that church is doing. Their leaven, their sin, read leaven to be sin, malice and wickedness. That's what characterizes that church. That's not what should characterize any church. I mean, it's just a big, big problem. And he says, but instead with the unleavened bread. Now why? Because the Feast of Unleavened Bread, you eat unleavened bread, called the bread of affliction. Now, metaphorically, we will eat the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. Make some sense? It's all using the metaphors, but he's really saying clean up your life and clean up that church. And that's really what he's getting at. Jesus' sacrifice for us set us free from sin. The Jewish people in the Old Testament are remembering God brought them out of Egypt. We're remembering Christ brought us out of the bondage to sin. We're now free to serve, and we should be motivated by what he did to actually want to live holy lives, eating the bread of sincerity and truth. Hope that makes some sense. We should be motivated as Christians to be better because we've been set free to be better, to be, you know, we're able to do it. So I hope that makes some sense. Well, I wrote to you in an epistle not to company with fornicators. No, this is verse 9. This tells us that 1 Corinthians, as we call it, really is 2 Corinthians, and some would argue it's 3 Corinthians. But you see, he wrote a letter before, and we don't have it. God could have made sure it was preserved and part of the Bible. He didn't. I have no idea why. I just know the letter existed, and God wanted us to know it existed. It may well be that they got Paul's letter, and they read it, and they took it at the top and ripped it down to the bottom and threw it in the incinerator, and then they got a second letter. I don't know. What we do know is they didn't fix the problem. He addressed issues, and he says this. He says, you know, I sent you another letter about keeping in company with fornicators. That's a very broad term for people engaged in sexual sins. And the company he's talking about is this man with the affair with the stepmother. That's who he's talking about, although there are probably other instances because, that's what he wrote to them before. It's apparently an issue. He says, yet not altogether with the fornicators of this world. Now, the King James is a little rough here, but what he's saying in verse 10 is simply this. When I told you before to not keep company with fornicators, I didn't mean to never have any company with people who are lost folks who live like lost folks live. And I think that's maybe how they took his letter, because that was easy. They said, well, we'll just stay away from those lost people, but our Christian friends that are fornicators, that have affairs with their stepmothers and all that, that's okay because they're Christians, right? Not only Christians are Baptists, right? I mean, I understood we couldn't hang with the Methodists, but these are Baptist guys, right? People think like this in weird ways. And so he says, so not altogether with the fornicators of this world. Now, what does this mean? He says, or, because some of us think, well, I don't hang out with any fornicators. The covetous, who are covetous people? What is it that really would characterize a person who's covetous?
They want what others have.
They want what others have, which will indicate envy. Yeah. Do they want more of the Spirit of God?
Absolutely.
Or do you think they want more of the worldly stuff like money and?
Yeah.
But see, it's the stuff. These are materialistic people, right? They do. They're going to envy when they see somebody else, you know. And we all have our weaknesses. It's why I almost always avoid antique car shows. It's one of the only times I really, really, really see stuff that. Yeah. Well, I had to go to an antique car show yesterday, and I saw about 5 or 6 '57. Well, my grandson was selling watermelon there at Hempstead, so I had to go. But then a long line of '57 Chevys were passed me by, and I would say that the spirit's willing, but the flesh is weak. But we have our issues, and he's talking about these people that are. Their life is entirely materialistic, or extortioners. They're going to cheat other people out of money. Idolaters. He says, I'm not telling you altogether to not have anything to do with those people who are in the world or of the world, because then you must needs go out of the world. When you learn church history, one of the things that arose very early in church history was what we might call monasticism. Sometimes we call it asceticism, but people started, you know, this idea of being a monk, and they would go out and live in the desert, and they wouldn't work. They had reasons why you can't work. They managed to get money. People would support them. They thought kind of legends arose around some of these guys, and they really thought, well, these are the most holy guys, and so we should give them money and stuff. And we have monks today, Christian monks. They go under different labels, and I'm not going to start naming names and all that, but I'll just tell you this. It's not a biblical concept to be a monk in that way. And he says you would have to go out of this world, and his whole thing is, like really, the only way you can altogether avoid these people, hey, good morning, is to essentially go in hiding. And that's exactly what he doesn't want you to do. This book's all about unity and not having the division. He's not suggesting anybody go in hiding.
You got a chair here, Ken.
You want to sit over here? Okay. So, but he says, now I've written unto you to not keep company if any man that's called a brother, meaning he's called a Christian, be such and such. Now, Paul doesn't get into whether the guy's really a Christian or not, and we have to be careful with that, but what he is saying, if someone's held out as being a Christian, and they're engaged in all these things, and I think the idea is they're openly doing this, or at least it's a consistent practice, the fornication, that could take a lot of different paths, right? That could be having an affair with a stepmother, having any sort of affair. I've lost track of the number of men in Christian churches and women that I've met that were having affairs. Many of them were pastors. Many of the Baptist pastors I've known of, and I know some who are still pastors now, are married to their secretaries. How did that happen? Well, they traded in, right? And it's common. And the church was fine with it because he could still be a pastor there. People at some leading churches have done that. This is a problem, okay? And the reason is because a lot of men in the church have lacked the spine to do what needed to be done when it happened. A person that was the most influential teacher in my life did the same thing. He had an affair, a long-time affair in the church. This church was an elder-run church, so it's kind of like you have five or six men that all, even though they don't all teach from the pulpit every Sunday or essentially have equal authority, they found out about it on a Saturday morning. They fired him on a Saturday morning, and they posted on the internet. So anyone who was coming to the church would know exactly what happened and why they did it. That's the right way to do it, in my opinion. I think it's extraordinary in our day. What's more likely to happen is to sweep things under the rug. Churches have a bad habit of sweeping things under the rug. I met with a pastor about a year and a half or so back, and we were talking about sweeping things under the rug, and you know, he had to call the police on someone on his staff because of their sexual misconduct. Go ahead.
When I went into ministry, my mentor pastor told me two things. He said, number one, if you're going to steal from the church, make it worth your while. And he said, the second thing is, keep your zipper up.
Yeah.
The two things that he told me.
Seems simple, right?
Yeah. And he's right.
And it's interesting you mentioned that, like stealing from the church and keeping your pants on. It's an epidemic problem. It's even happening among pastors. A young pastor I know had shared with me, and he was just 3 or 4 years out of school. He's a youth pastor. And he said that at least 4 or 5 of the young couples he met while they were all, you know, at pastor school had already divorced. These are people in their 20s. Who would have told you that God had called them to the pastorate? I'm just saying that there's a lot of this going on, and then, you know, and you've got it here in a church, and you like you mentioned the stealing happens more than you think. Been in a church where someone had stolen $100,000 from it, and they made a decision to let it go. Now I'm not re-guessing that decision necessarily, but I'm just telling you, don't think those things don't happen. They absolutely do. And part of why I think is sometimes because not dealing with some of these problems when they start that he's dealing with here. He says, I've written with you not to keep company with the person who's held out as a Christian. He's not discussing whether they really are, really or not, but they're held out as a Christian. See, as soon as you say you're a Christian, you're a member of the church, it's different. If a visitor comes in, and we have to be sensitive to this, and you know, we may chat with them a little bit, and you learn some things. You might learn some things you don't approve of. They're not a member of the church, and maybe they're not even a Christian. let it go. Your first message to them is the gospel message, and if they've got some issues they're dealing with, like they think it's okay to smoke weed or whatever it is that bothers you, that's for another time, because you can't make your message that we're going to get non-Christians to live the way Christians ought to live. But when you have someone that's a Christian in the church who tells you that they've got a problem, you know, and one of the more common ones now is pornography, my response is usually going to be, what are you doing to deal with it? If you're doing nothing, that's a big problem. If you're doing something, then you know, it's not necessarily that we need this person kicked out of the church, but I'm telling you, you got to be doing something. So there, at least in some bigger churches I've been a part of, there were some groups to try to help men deal with some of these things. I don't know what the success rate is, but it's important, because that issue is a marriage killer. Many marriages that end in a divorce, the other woman was a computer screen. I mean, it happens. And I'll say this: it's not just the men, obviously. The statistics are alarming, but it's a real common problem that men struggle with. And if you're going to have that issue and you're not doing anything about it, you find yourself here in this passage. What he's talking about, he says, don't keep company with the man called a Christian who's a fornicator. Now, this isn't, he had an affair 10 years ago and him and his wife reconciled and he's gotten over it. We're not beating people up for the past, but you're currently engaged in a sin practice and you won't stop it. Don't have anything to do with him, he says. The covetousness, that's a completely materialistic Christian. An idolater, a railer, someone who's always fighting. It's interesting he lists these other words, because it's easy for a lot of us to say, well, you know, I haven't had an affair on the wife yet. Are you always fighting with people? A railer, a drunkard. He says nothing about drinking. He's going to talk about the Lord's Supper later. He used wine for the Lord's Supper. But what he is talking about is being a drunk. And I can remember years ago going to this, we had some Friday event at where I was working, where we went to this place. It's actually called the State Bar. It's a play on words, because the State Bar regulates the attorneys in the state of Texas. But there was a literal bar called the State Bar. And what occurred to me, and I'd only been, like a few times I'd been there, and there were some of the same people always there. It was like watching a show that used to be on TV called Cheers. And frankly, if men are always there who are married men and have a family at home, that's a big problem. I'm talking about in the evening when they ought not to be there. Okay, it's like David, King David, being back on the top of his castle watching a naked woman take a shower when he's supposed to be off at war. You read about that in First or Second Samuel. So, just to say, you know, you see these issues and this issue of alcoholism. Okay, I mean, I'll call it that. I don't believe in isms, but people who can no longer, they've lost all control of their drinking. If they're trying to deal with it, we need to help them. We don't need to shoot the wounded. If they're proud of it, look, I'm a drunk and I'm just the way I am, always going to be this way, that's fine. You don't need to be that way here. All right? And these are tough words. And you know, what about an extortioner? People that cheat people out of money. You think those people aren't in churches? Not only are they in churches, you can usually spot them if you'll keep your eyes open and your ears open. Especially when they're people that use the church, not only to sell their wares, which isn't necessarily a problem. You meet people and you may do business with them. They've got some kind of scheme to profit from people, often with it's not honest. Let me just say it that way. And I've seen it come through a number of times, and it's a problem. And you're going to see when we get to chapter 6, maybe we'll get to start in a minute, they're suing one another. This is probably one of the reasons why, because when Christians cheat one another, they sue one another, right? That's what they, especially in the United States, we sue people all the time. We'll talk about litigation in a minute, because it's alive and well in the United States church. And he says, now with such a one, don't eat. Ooh. Yeah, why? Well, I think, and this, I won't be dogmatic about this, I think his thing about not eating is probably not to share the Passover meal, meaning the Lord's Supper, in this context. He'll come back to that in chapter 11, and he'll say, if you've got this sin issue going on in your life persisting, you shouldn't drink. You shouldn't partake in the Passover. He says some of you are asleep from this. That is, God has killed you because you know, some people in the church were taking it unworthily. It's possible. And a lot of the commentators will suggest that this is more than just not going to Cabo's in Brenham, Texas with this sinner. It's not even sharing the Lord's Supper. Why? The Lord's Supper is the ultimate unity of the church. For Paul, when he talks about the Lord's Supper later, the time when this church is symbolically unified is when we partake in the Lord's Supper together. And to exclude this brother from fellowship would include especially that part where we all come together and do the Lord's Supper. So it's a real possibility that that's what he has in mind.
But also, really, when you're dealing with somebody that you know is that kind of a person, and you continue to fellowship, there's a tendency for his influence to influence you or whatever.
Yep.
And Paul says, stay away from that kind of stuff because you can be affected by it. You know, when I was a youth minister, we always did this skit where I'd have someone stand in a chair, and then I would ask another person to just try to pull them down, and they'd pull them down real easy. And I said, okay, now let's reverse it. The bad guy stand in the chair and try to pull that somebody up, and it doesn't happen. So, you know, it's easier for us to be pulled away from God than it is for us to be close to him.
And it seems like that's what's happened in this church. Right? He said earlier, just a few verses earlier, that you're glorying, boasting, puffed up about this guy having this affair. Instead of being, he had said you should have been mourning his sin and the fact that it's in the church, and you're puffed up. So it's exactly right. It's an influence on us. And I'll just say, you know, do you reach out and try to help a brother who's struggling? Absolutely. They have to want the help. They have to be willing. And let's talk about the guy with the affair very specifically. When this came up in a Sunday school class I taught, and some of the men said, aren't we supposed to do something? I said, yes, we are. And we talked to him. And my thing was, you're going to stop the affair today. You're not going to have further contact with the mistress that you're putting on social media, period. And if you're not willing to do that, then you're not going to be part of us. You can judge that's too harsh or whatever, but you know you're a married man at church with your wife and three or four kids, and you are persisting in an affair. You don't go talk to her and reason it through. Men come up with these really extraordinary excuses for the stupid things they do, and then they say, and if you confront some people with this thing, you're going to hear it. You'll hear the drunk tell you it's different from me than you because I have an addiction. You're going to hear the guy that has multiple affairs. And by the way, that's not all. That's usually the exception. Most men that have affairs, if you deal with them, they feel bad and they know it's wrong all the way through. But sometimes you get some guys that it's just a way of life. And they were that way when they were married. I always tell people, whoever that is, however bad he is, he's who you married. He usually hasn't changed any. But it was hip and cool, or you thought he would change, or whatever. But you know, they're going to tell, well, I'm a sex addict. See, it's different for you. You have it easy. You're not a sex addict. Here's the deal. I'm a sin addict. So are you. See, we have this sin nature. Now, my sin of choice, in other words, I may not struggle in the same area someone else does. I've never struggled with alcohol. To me, it's iced tea. I could have it or not have it, doesn't matter. I can place a limit. I've had people for different reasons, because people don't understand the New Testament, say, well, if you want to participate in ministry here, you know, you can't, you know, drink anymore. And I've agreed to that for years at a time. I won't have any alcohol, you know. Fine, I don't care. You know, according to what Jesus says, when we're at the Revelation 19, at the marriage feast of the Lamb, I'm going to drink wine with him, but whatever. There are a lot of men I know, though, and some of them were family members, and I watched them. You know, they couldn't come to a family reunion without just being so drunk they couldn't even walk out. They couldn't control it. And it cost them everything. It cost them their job. It cost them their family, which is why I never push anybody to drink. But it's interesting. See, he had that struggle. I didn't. It doesn't mean I don't have struggles. My struggles are different. And a lot of men that, you know, and I've met so many of them, because it's the most common issue, anytime someone says, I'd like to talk to you, or having this or that marriage issue, there's one of two issues that are always present. Either one, he won't work, or two, the porn, usually three, both, but particularly the porn thing. And it just, you know, it's a marriage killer, because you live in a fantasy world where you have fake relationships, and it's killer. But there's other issues, right, that people struggle with, and it's, you know, materialism and just the need to gain affluence and stuff can consume people. But don't believe the ism thing. We all have this addiction, and we need to deal with it. But if someone just won't deal with their issues and they just want to go with the I'm proud of it and I'm going to flaunt it, then it becomes this issue Paul's saying, and he says you've got to take the leaven out of the lump. The lump is the local church, because it'll destroy it. For what have I to do to judge them also that are without? That means outside the church. Paul says, it's a rhetorical question. What do I have to do to judge those with, you know, what business is it of mine to judge those outside the church? The answer is none. It's the reason, you know, and he has in mind, like, a non-Christian. Why? Because people get shocked. They do. They read the news and they look at what people are saying and they say, I'm just beside myself. How could they possibly think that? The Bible said that's the way they'll think. Read Romans 1. You read Romans 1, and he talks about this descent of unsaved mankind, where God gives them over and gives them over. What's happening? Their brains are loose. It's not just what they do, it's how they think. It's completely untethered to reality.
I heard on the news this morning that in L.A. County, they're not even prosecuting shoplifters unless it's over
$10,000.
$900.
$900. It's still $900.
And
walked out, and
they don't even stop.
And the store won't stop you either.
No.
Because the store will get sued if they stop you. Yeah. Most stores, by the way, most stores have that right now. Like, if you want to steal from dealers, just go grab your stuff and walk out.
I've seen
it's a store policy not to stop them.
I saw an academy. Home Depot, a guy walked right by the line with stuff, and I went over to the manager, the guy standing there, on both occasions, and said, "Hey, this guy's taking
stuff." Let him go.
Stuff. He goes, "We can't do anything about
that's
it."
Right.
Really?
So,
why not?
They follow him out to the car. They take a picture of his license plate.
Give it to police.
Send it to the police, but nothing ever happens.
That's right. Nothing happens. And nothing will happen when they come steal from the church either. I can vouch for that. But. Unless they do it while we're in a church service, because I had, no, I you would.
Under the law.
They just won't.
What?
They won't. I'm telling you the reality.
Why not?
Lack of resources and bigger fish.
And for every case they do, they try to prosecute. Regardless of what happens, it's going to cost them a minimum of $10,000.
Yeah, it's very expensive.
When I was working doing team security for the Texans, any incident whatsoever against a fan immediately was going to cost them a minimum of $10,000.
Oh, wow.
To try to do anything.
The minute that becomes common knowledge,
yeah,
you're going to have an...
Well, that's the point.
Yeah.
That was the point about LA. They're doing it in daylight.
I guess they go in there with a calculator.
Yeah. So,
where do they stop? How about
So you see, but you see the
just walking out here.
The problem is us trying to judge those people. Now, it's a separate issue, wanting the law enforced. We'll leave that where it's at. We all have our very strong views about that. But Paul says, essentially, I don't have any business judging those without. This is why we need to be careful about, as Christians, letting our fundamental and our foundational message to a lost world be, you need to stop doing this, 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 and this, and this. Because I tell you this, stopping doing all those things will not get you into heaven. See, our foundational message is a gospel message. We want to catch our fish, then clean them, not the other way around. And so Paul says, I ain't got any business judging those people. It's not that he doesn't have a view on it. It's not that he doesn't think it's sin. They're acting the way he expects. His business, though, is them within the local church. And by the way, it's this local church. If First Baptist Brenham has a problem, First Baptist Brenham will deal with it. Not my business. Okay. Now, if there's a national preacher that's well known and they're teaching some false doctrine, I might address that. But as a general matter, it's not my business to be concerned about judging somebody in another church. But when somebody in the church where I'm a member at has publicly flaunted sin of this serious of a nature, Paul would say, then that's my business. See, them that are without God judges, and he does. Romans 1 says that the wrath of God is poured out on unrighteousness. Not tomorrow, he says now, present tense. Therefore, he says, put away from among yourselves that wicked person. So I'd raised the question last week that you know, one way to maybe take this would be that Paul wants this person, it's not that they're kicked out of the church and you guard the doors and they can never come back in. It's just that they're essentially removed from the fellowship role, if you will. They're like persona non grata. I think the better way of taking it is probably they're not welcome to come back. Now, in a modern context, that becomes a little more complicated. But you
can that be, says this, I think, a little more explicitly, it says on 12.
Mm-hmm.
So what business is it of mine to judge those outside the church?
Yeah.
Are you not to judge those inside? God will judge those outside. Expel the wicked man from among you.
Yeah, it's very strong language, and it's hard for me. All I will say is the handful of times I've been involved with this happening, people left the church over it. Okay? So we had essentially a couple that had split, but they hadn't divorced. The wife was a member of the church, and the husband was a member of the church. And the wife was, you know, had shacked up with somebody. And you know, they approached her. Now, Paul doesn't talk a lot about it here. Some would go with some text in Matthew 18 that Jesus talks about approaching someone individually and then maybe taking a couple of witnesses and then, you know, if you have to, taking it before the church. But, you know, after pleading with her that you know, he's not saying you have to go live with your husband again. That's a different issue. But you're married and shouldn't be living with some other dude. Being a member of this church, and we, you know, had a letter that said, and the church voted on it, assembly, you're excluded from our fellowship. And then you had the people who quit the church and left because of that, because it wasn't loving. You'll have it every time, I guarantee you. My own view of that, let them go. But if you're going to do this and think about it, you do need to know the basis and kind of come to your conviction about if that's right, to, in some circumstances, and I see this as being rare, you let them go. Paul says you have to. Why? Because a little leaven leavens the whole lump. He's saying that sin is contagious. Just is. So, dare any of you, now he's changing subject matter, dare any of you having a matter against another go to law before the unjust? In other words, go to court. And not before the saints. Now, this passage, that we'll be able to move through more quickly, but I love this passage because he's talking about lawyers. The church has members within it that are suing each other, and that may seem odd to you, but it shouldn't. First, people sue churches all the time. I get emails every day that is like all the lawsuits filed, say, in Harris County and in some other big counties like wherever Dallas is, Austin. You'd be surprised. I don't think a week would go by without some church being sued, usually by a member. For different things, which is, I mean, if someone slips in the parking lot, they're going to sue you.
Oh yeah.
Someone slips on, you know, if there's an election and someone, you know, for officers in the church and someone thinks it wasn't done in the way it should have been done, you might have a lawsuit. I've seen it. I always look and see why, because it'll give me a little blur of why they're suing. Just the idea of suing the church because you think the election of a committee or a deacon or something been different. I had a former member of the church when I was on staff at a church, a former member, he calls me. He had a machine shop or something, and he had sold it to a member of the church. And then he left the church later because he moved. And it was like a lot of guys that build a small business and they sell it and there's like a profit runoff where he's going to get money from it for years going forward. And he said this guy wasn't, who was now a deacon of the church I'm at, so my deacon isn't allegedly, you know, paying all his profits over. So let me get this straight. You used to go to this church and you want me, the executive pastor of the church, to represent you to sue my own deacon. Yeah. And he didn't find something, you know, abnormal or like I said, you know, I wanted to say it in stronger words, but, you know, what are you full of, right? I mean, you know, this is bad. I mean, people think this way. I had a young lady I worked with, I mean, this was 20 years ago, but she went to a very large church, and I knew the church, and she was, you know, buying her first house and getting it built, and she met a contractor in this big church, and he was going to build it for her. And the short of it was, you know, it was supposed to have all the appliances, like most new houses, and he wouldn't deliver them. Just said, you know, and he's sitting, you know, across the pew from her in this big church. What do I do? You know what I told her? I said, you're going to have to eat it. It's unfortunate. You're going to see Paul say that in a minute. You're going to have to eat it or ask if someone in the church will arbitrate it. I've only seen that done in one Bible church I knew of. I'm not saying it's never done. I'm telling you it's just so rare that at least in many churches I've been in, no one's ever even countenanced the idea that if two people in the church have a dispute and they just can't resolve it, that they could go and find somebody in the church wise enough, it doesn't have to be Solomon, but wise enough to arbitrate their dispute with the agreement that y'all live by it and I'm going to let it go after that. If it doesn't go my way, I'm going to let it go.
One of the problems that honestly, being a pastor for 27 years, there's really nothing that surprises me in the church that they do outside the world.
Right.
I mean, it affects the church just like it does outside the world. Right. And let me give you a case in point. I went to one church, and they had a church school that was running everything, and they wanted to take over part of the sanctuary and build a library. I said, no, we're not going to do that. Well, they were like $40,000 in debt. I started looking at the books. And almost invariably, those that weren't helping pay for the school teachers were my members. Now, why is that? You know, it's wrong.
Yeah.
And I brought it to their attention. Well, you don't understand. I said, no, you don't understand. If you made a commitment, you need to honor that commitment, period. I don't care whether you can't pay your utility bill or not. You know, because it was a you know, a private school. So, you're right. These kind of things, don't be surprised if you see that in the church, because it's there. Because we're human beings, we're sinners, and God expects better of us, but He knows what we're going to do.
But when it happens, let's you know, because a lot of times when these things happen, people just start having all these ideas about what ought to be done. Start with a very simple question, and I've said it to all of us before here. We need to learn to think biblically. That's an ongoing process our whole lives, to think biblically. And that means, when these things happen, ask yourself, does the Bible speak to this directly or by principle? In the case of this litigation thing, like this and this lady, she did what I told her, and she let it go, you know, but it's hard. It's hard to have someone sell you a house and never deliver the appliances, and you have to go out and spend several thousand dollars. A Christian in your church who's gonna look polished and sing and do all those things on Sunday lied to you. He cheated you. Now, you're either going to eat it, or Paul will say, find a wise person. I think he has in mind it could be a pastor, or elder, or a few of them. Let them arbitrate the dispute.
Why do you say just let it go? I mean, I understand the part finding somebody in the church to...
He doesn't want you to sue them. Yeah, what I mean by letting it go is, I mean, don't go to the Harris County Courthouse and file a lawsuit.
But why would you do that?
People do it all the time. You sue them to get your money back, right? To get your appliances.
Right. No, I'm saying, why would you let it go? I mean, because, now, I can understand going to the church first, but I don't understand if that doesn't work, why you wouldn't take them to court.
Well, I'll show you. One is, the first answer is because the Bible says so. But
well, where does it say?
He's fixing to say it. Let's look. So he has rhetorical questions first. He says, you know, rhetorically, you know, dare any of you, like how dare you, having a matter against another, and the implication he'll make clear is in your church. Okay, so go to law or go to court before the unjust. Now that word unjust is unrighteous. Next week I'll go back to this verse. This becomes critical to understanding a difficult verse later in the chapter. But the word unjust is the unrighteous. It's Paul's word for a lost person. You're going to a court, in other words, a secular court, before the unjust, and not before the saints. You could go and take this to fellow Christians in your church. don't you know, I've bolded it, do you not know, don't you know that the saints shall judge the world? And I won't get into all of that, but there's not a whole lot about that in the Bible, but we apparently have some role as Christians in the final judgment. Jesus would say things like, the men of Nineveh will rise in judgment against this generation. That's in Matthew. He says, if the world will be judged by you, if you're going to be part of this eschatological judgment of all this unsaved people in the whole world, you're not worthy to judge the smallest matters. See, you're going to be involved in eschatological huge judgment involving Jesus, and this is like a biting criticism of them when he says that. You don't think there's one person in your church that's got the horsepower to judge the smallest matters? See, they were all puffed up. That was part of their division. Lots of pride. These were the smart people. And it's an argument from greater to lesser. It's a common way of rabbis arguing. If the saints are qualified to participate in the judgment of the world, they should be qualified to deal with smaller matters. So, you know, don't you know, or know you not, that we shall judge angels as well? And that's, again, not a lot of detail about what exactly that entails, but we have some role there. If you're going to judge angels, these supernatural beings, can you not judge some other folks in the church that have a dispute?
You know what that's had in the Bible about judging angels?
Well, it's there is a judgment of angels in the book of Jude and in 2 Peter chapter 2. And it gets complicated because there's not a lot of detail, because those first century Jews apparently understood. And then, of course, in Revelation, when Satan is thrown into the lake of fire, his demons with him, yeah. I don't know what our role is. I thought about that too. Like, Paul says this, but he never fills out exactly what role we play. Jesus hints at it when he talks about the men of Nineveh rising in judgment.
Well, weren't the demons considered angels to Satan?
Well,
that aspect too, so well, that might be
they were all angels, but it gets complicated because you have two groups, right? You've got the angels from Genesis 6 that married women, and we'll not get into that can of worms, and they're held in some place the Bible calls Tartarus. But the point is, you know, for Paul, because I thought about that, he really doesn't build it out anywhere exactly what we'll do, but his point is, you're going to have a role there, you're qualified to do that. How much more the things that pertain to this life, mere kind of daily matters. If then you have judgments of things pertaining to this life, set them to judge who are least esteemed in the church. And here I put an alternative non-King James translation because I think it's better. This is from the New English Translation. That verse 4, he's asking a question. You know, the Greek text doesn't have punctuation like question marks, so sometimes you have to look at it and decide. But he says, if you have ordinary lawsuits, you know, if you've got these ordinary lawsuits going on in the church, where church members in this church, okay, I'm not talking about the fact that you might have to sue another Christian who goes to the Third Baptist Church in Brenham or whatever. He's not even talking about that, although I find that somewhat problematic. But he's talking about two people that are in the First Baptist Church of Chapel Hill who are members of it, who are suing each other. That's his context. He says, if you have that, do you appoint as judges those that have no standing in the church? Get it? We have two people in the church suing each other. Why are you appointing this pagan over here at the district court in Harris County or Washington County to deal with it? He says, don't do it.
The problem with what you're talking about, and also relates back to what you spoke about earlier, is there is no penalty in the church except for one. If, for example, that person cheated the other person in the church, then he needs to get his...
That's right. That's exactly right. They might be excluded.
Because that's the only option you have. I mean, if you go to a civil court, you can do a lot of different things. One is put him in jail, the other one is force him to pay.
Well, I tell you what I would do. If I was a pastor and knew that was happening, I'd sit down with him and say, tell me your justification for why you're doing this.
Absolutely.
And maybe you can convict the guy.
Yeah, but if he disagrees, what's your option?
Well, get out of the church.
That's the only one.
Yeah, no, there's limited options because a lot of people are cool with this stuff until it's them that lost something.
Yeah.
What happens when two Christians have a quarrel in the church that the whole church comes to know about it? What happens next? The whole church all of a sudden knows that so-and-so and so-and-so...
They pick sides, for one thing.
Exactly. They pick sides. That's the problem. And I'm
not
telling you,
this happened quite
often. No, look, it does happen.
I had a semi-relative cheated my daughter.
Hmm? If
he admitted it to him, and he wouldn't do anything about it. We didn't go to the same church, and
It's a difficult issue. What I'm suggesting, and what Paul's going to say here, look what he says. He says, "I speak to your shame. So shame on you for having these lawsuits. Is it so that there's not a wise man among you?" That's sarcasm, because they all think they're wise. He dealt with that in the first four chapters. He preaches the wisdom of God. No, not one that could judge between his brothers. So there's not one smart guy in the whole church. You know, this probably ruffled some feathers. But brother goes to law with brother, and that before unbelievers. Now, therefore, there's utterly a fault among you. Why? Because you're going to the courthouse, one with another. You're suing each other. Why don't you rather take the wrong? Why not rather suffer to be defrauded? This is a difficult issue, but there are times in your life, not just in the church, where you could turn the other cheek, and it may cost you something, but you might avoid a rift in the family or a rift in the church. And that's hard to do. It takes a lot bigger man to do that than to turn it into a fist fight or turn it into litigation. And it's not always easy. Now, I'm not talking about necessarily criminal activity. This whole idea that you find out that so-and-so is, I'm talking things I've seen in a church. You know, this guy is it's an incestual relationship with his stepdaughter and stuff, and we don't want the church, this will be too much trouble in the church. No. When that came up, it was real simple. We called the pokey. They came out and put him in cuffs. There was, sorry, butt in the back of the squad car. But when you've had a deal, and you could maybe prevent a blow-up, I think he says do it.
And I figured out how to handle that situation. That lady needs to join a different church. And then she can sue the guy in the church.
you're already thinking like a lawyer. So.
Well, I'll say this, too. A lot of times, you know, we may want to take things in our own hands and do things, but you know who's the best judge of all? Let God deal with them.
And he'll deal with them better.